Traffic file, enter feed out.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me. This is work based on a paper which came out this year with Joshua Ehrlich, currently of the University of Washington in Seattle. And I'm going to briefly mention some other work which I'm pursuing with Tamoy Bhattacharya of Los Alamos and Josh. So I'd like to begin with an old saying. Bondi was giving a talk years ago in Cambridge and emphasized gravitons and energy through the famous saying that you can heat water with. Of course, you might be waiting around the microwave for a while, but the principle, this is a true statement, of course. You can heat water with them. What, if anything, I would like you to take away, well, I hope you take away more than this, is that the gravitational field carries information. You could build TV sets. Now, again, the reception might not be up to par, but theoretically it's possible. Certainly not in America. That's fair enough. Okay. Certainly. That's right. That's right. The alien programming. Okay. Maybe the Earth is a reality TV show over there or something. So what I'm going to try to convince you of, so I should have left that up just an instant more. You might say, this is a trivial point. Of course, this is true. Why are you making it? What about this takes us beyond what Bondi said? Well, I think this gets at the core of the philosophy that the entropy bounds have taught me. And that is that, if anything, what we're looking for is a theory that relates information in some raw or primary form to emergent concepts, such as space-time, and perhaps even fields in space-time. And so by focusing on where and how information can be stored in a space-time, I think you're getting closer to that sort of thing. So in other words, the philosophy, just to put it in cartoon form, is that information is more fundamental than things like energy. And so that's why that's an interesting statement. So I'm going to talk about entropy bounds today. There are a number of experts here, and so this is going to bore them to tears, and I apologize. But I often find that it's useful to go through the details of things so that everyone can follow along. So this all begins, in many ways, with a question posed to Bekenstein years ago. You throw a coffee cup, some entropic system, into a black hole, and the area of the mass increases. So where did all the information about the system that you threw in go? And Hawking had proved an intriguing theorem that the area of black holes always have to increase.
Yeah,
you know, there's a pointer. Ah, good point. Point. And so he started to speculate, could that increase in the entropy correspond to an increase in the area? And indeed, his proposal was that the entropy of a black hole is proportional to the area with some order unity constant out front. Well, we have this relation from thermodynamics. If the mass grows and the entropy grows, these things better have a temperature. Of course, Hawking showed that they radiate with a certain rate, about in four dimensions, 10 to the 26 Kelvin over the mass. And so Hawking, if you like, fixed the constant of proportionality to be a fourth. Bekenstein didn't stop there, though. He said, well, the universe isn't all just black holes. There's also matter. So we need to introduce the idea of a total entropy, which is all the matter entropy plus the black hole entropy. And he proposed then that this system would satisfy a generalized second law, namely that total entropy could only ever increase. Remarkably, this generically seems to hold. For example, for an evaporating black hole, Don Page, in a very Pageian calculation, show that the final matter entropy is 62% greater for a Schwarzschild black hole in four dimensions than the initial black hole entropy. So just in case you're wondering, Don is always there. But Bekenstein still wasn't finished. He noticed more. He noticed that if the matter entropy was arbitrarily large, you could violate the generalized second law. So in 1981, he argued for this thing called the Bekenstein bound, which is the statement that for a weakly gravitating matter system in an asymptotically flat space, the entropy in the matter is bounded from above, in essence, ignoring these constants, by the energy times the radius. This radius, basically, you can view as the radius of the smallest sphere, which could encompass the system. And this is a weakly gravitating statement. You'll notice there are no factors of g in the statement of the Bekenstein bound.
So I don't want to derail your question. I want to register the comment that one can make a number of objections to those arguments.
And you have, yes. Yes. Okay. So, to my knowledge at least, this was the first entropy bound. Like all entropy bounds, you can violate it using, for example, questionable matter, you know, if you allow arbitrary number species. And like all good entropy bounds, or what you might regard as a good entropy bound, it saturates for a black hole. And the limit that your isolated system forms a black hole, i.e. when 2 times energy is 2 times the mass, then the entropy is exactly pi r squared.
Saturates at
the 40% energy. Yeah. As we'll see today.
Energy and radius are related to each other, so there's no freedom. It saturates for a black hole at any radius. But actually, it saturates only for dimensions.
Okay. These sorts of ruminations led people like Atuft and Seskind to put forward the holographic principle, which in cartoon form, again, crudely says that information scales like the area of the boundary of a system. And this is where things start to get interesting. So what this means is that I can encode all the information in this room by tiling the walls with little Planck-sized squares and putting a 0 or a 1 in there. And that's quite striking, because you would have thought that things scale like the volume. So already we're starting to see something highly untrivial about how much information can be packed or moved through spaces, in some sense. So there's a natural question. Can you construct an entropy bound which holds in general? And there were lots of folks who wrote lots of papers about this. For example, I'll just mention one bound, which doesn't work. This was in a paper, just sort of discussed in a paper by Fischler and Seskind. So-called space-like bound. The idea of the bound is very simple. You just let V be any compact region of some space-like slice in some space-time, and it has some boundary, B. Then you simply say that the matter entropy in V is less than or equal to the area of the boundary over 4. And this is easily violated, e.g. by the universe, so to speak. We think space is flat on large scale, so volume scale is like 4/3 pi r cubed. Area scale is like 4 pi r squared. On the largest scales, the galaxies are just like dust particles, so there's some sort of constant entropy density. And you can show that for a large enough radius, which is determined by that energy density, you violate this bound. So you can't just flippantly write down bounds. You have to be careful. And also, you don't want to be formulating, you don't want to be defining your information on space-like surfaces, because that's not covariant. And so, primarily Fischler and Seskind put forward the idea, let's define entropy on surfaces which are light-like, null surfaces. Those are invariant under Lorentz transformations. Then you would have a covariant bound. There's just one problem with that. Given a space-like surface B to surface B, there are many orthogonal light-like surfaces which emerge from it. You can go out to the future and out to the future and in, and similarly in the past. And this is where Raphael comes into the story. He gives us a precise way of defining the light sheet. So here's the story. What you do is you let gamma be a family of orthogonal null curves from the space-like two-surface, B. So if you like, I'm arraying, of course, these curves don't actually correspond to light rays, but in a way, it's like you're arraying lights on the wall and firing in light rays orthogonally, if you like, if the walls of the room were the surface B. And you look at some little bundle of rays, and they'll have some cross-sectional area initially. And as you follow them along in a fine parameter lambda, they'll have some final cross-sectional area finally. And so you can define an expansion parameter, which tells you whether that cross-sectional area grows or shrinks. And it shrinks if the expansion theta is negative and grows if it's positive. And then you got theorems from the old days, from the Hawking-Penrose days, that if theta is less than 0 initially and energy conditions hold, then the curves hit a caustic in a finite amount of a fine parameter time. This goes to 0. So if you like, they cross each other. And so, This leads to a precise definition of a light sheet. You let B be a space like 2 surface. Then a light sheet is any one of the congruences that I just discussed, any of those orthogonal null congruences, satisfying theta less than or equal to 0 everywhere on the original surface B. Furthermore, each null ray in the congruence ends at a conjugate point. That's where you terminate the light sheet. That's what light sheets are. So now that we know what light sheets are, we have this statement. Let B be a space-like 2 surface. Let L of B be an associated light sheet. Suppose that this energy condition is satisfied. Then the entropy through the light sheet is less than or equal to the area of the bounding 2 surface over 4. So if you like, this is a precise way of choosing a sort of smallest light sheet. So you're most likely, if you like, to satisfy the entropy bound. Of course, many people raised many questions. For example, what do we mean by the entropy through a light sheet? What do those words mean? There was some issue raised by Lowe, and these have in many ways been dealt with. And you know how to violate energy conditions. We have the Casimir effect. Look like you might just violate these bounds. But then lo and behold, Flanagan-Meroff and Wall come along. They prove a theorem. And what I like about theorems is that once I have a theorem, I know that I'm doing something true, at least in the context of that theorem. And that's nice, because then you feel like you're doing something that's true in some sense. Okay. So this is the first supposition. So on the previous slide, I said, what is the entropy through a light sheet? Well, they're very precise about that. What you do is you suppose that the entropy can be well approximated by an entropy flux vector, S. So that's treating entropy like a fluid, if you like. It's not unbelievable for most things. Sounds plausible to me. Suppose further that for any null vector k, these two conditions hold. The entropy dotted into k is bounded from above by the stress energy and something that is called the shear of the light sheet. And this is going to be the key thing today, is the shear tensor. And suppose further that there's a rate, a bound on the rate at which the entropy flux can change. Then, in fact, if you define the entropy through the light sheet to be the integral over the light sheet, S dotted in K, again, K is some tangent to the light sheet, then that is less than the area of the boundary over 4. So that was their first theorem. That's a very precise theorem. And their second theorem says something very similar. Again, if this thing, this inequality, holes everywhere on the light sheet along each null geodesic generator. Basically, today I'm going to follow their conventions. This is actually the value of the fine parameter at the end of the light sheet. So at the caustic along each geodesic, you can always rescale that parameter. Then similarly, subject to that assumption, you get a real bound in the entropy. And in fact, they showed that the covariant entropy bound implies the generalized second law. And Busseau has also derived the Bekenstein bound. And so I actually think this is a very powerful set of ideas. I think it allows us to go out and do things that we might not have otherwise done or been able to do. And what I'm going to do, I can explain very quickly. So a long time ago, Roger Penrose gave me a problem. He had this crazy idea that the entropy of a black hole could be described. So his idea was, look, a black hole's vacuum. There's no stress energy tensor. Where's the entropy coming from? His idea was maybe it was somehow coming from the Weyl tensor, from the curvature of space-time itself. Now, I don't think anyone really believes that anymore. What I'm going to argue is that within the context of these bounds, you can explore the extent to which that idea might have been true. And the reason that you can explore the extent to which that idea might have been true has to do with the assumptions which go into the Flanagan-Meroff-Wall theorems. You see, what these things are really telling you is that if you have any entropy around, then you either have some stress-energy tensor where you have some of this shear tensor. However, it's been known for quite some time that if this is happening to a light sheet, in fact, Penrose wrote a paper on focusing in optics, if this is happening to a light sheet, then it really is due to matter. There's a certain kind of focusing associated with this. But if you're shearing your light sheet, and I'm going to describe in more detail what shear does in an upcoming transparency, then really that means that gravitational degrees of freedom are registering on the light sheet. And this is consistent with Bondi's definition of the gravitational energy flux at infinity. And as I'm going to discuss today, Indian guy from, I can't believe I just forgot his name. From Penn. Ashtekar, thank you. That's kind of a bizarre slip there. Ashtekar has proved some very interesting energy flux formulae for black holes, which involve the Schier squared, and which are very consistent with what Josh and I did. So this makes sense, as either TAB and sigma can cause caustics, and therefore in the light sheet. That is to say, if either the Schier squared is greater than zero or the stress energy, then you're going to get, this thing's going to hit minus infinity faster, basically. You're going to cause the thing to terminate faster, and that's generally what you want information to do. You don't want too much information to get through your light sheet. So if you try to pack too much information through the light sheet, you want the light sheet to sort of save itself, save the bound by sealing off earlier. Both of these things do that to your light sheet. So what's the difference? Well, now I'm going to use some terms borrowed from the Penrose paper. The difference is anastigmatic versus astigmatic focusing. He borrowed some terms from lensing, I suppose. Anastigmatic simply focuses neighboring curves more quickly. So this is matter. Whereas in the case of shearing, what happens is that things which are initially spherical basically get deformed into elliptical shapes. And of course, that's what we expect of a graviton. If you have a ball of dust free falling out in space and a graviton hits it, it gets polarized that way or that way or that way or that way. So this is very consistent with our intuition about what gravitons do. They're just doing it to light in this case. So in other words, if a light sheet is shear, it's detecting purely gravitational degrees of freedom. And indeed, this reminds us of Penrose's old bell curvature hypothesis. In fact, I can't resist just papers from 1966. It suggested that the focusing power of space-time curvature along an O-way is a good measure of the total energy flux, matter plus gravitation. And he really did analyze in detail what these gravitational fluctuations do to light-like surfaces. He had no concept of a light sheet. He had no concept of entropy bounds. All I'm putting this up for is to emphasize that it's kind of like if you replace energy with entropy, it's similar in spirit to the entropy bounds. The key point here is we're regarding entropy as more fundamental than energy. That's the philosophy. And so I would just reference recent work of Ashtekar et al., How Horizons Grow. Here he's interested in throwing stuff like a graviton into a horizon and watching it grow. We're letting it shrink, watching Hawking radiation come out. And what a dynamic horizon is it's a three-dimensional surface with the property that each leaf in the surface, you can foliate it by leaves. So as I flow along, I have a leaf here, I have a leaf up here. So I have two-dimensional, codimension one surfaces foliating this three-dimensional manifold. And each leaf in the foliation is marginally trapped. In particular, there's always a null vector with vanishing expansion, and then the other one always has negative expansion. So this is the point of no return for any observer who is playing around in the space-time. So that's what dynamic horizons are. And what Ashtekar has shown... well, that's theta equal... Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah. A dynamic horizon, I guess, because it's dynamic. He's emphasizing the dynamic.
This is a special case. The current horizon that you define once you've given a foliation. Here, Alpi specifies the foliation from some other geometric constraints, from some other geometric reasons a priori.
Right.
So it gives you a special case for the current horizon. But there are also current horizons on different slices that coincide with that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's right. The apparent horizon is dependent on the choice of space-like surface, right. And this is a more space-time.
Yeah. Also, I guess he wants to emphasize that it's dynamical, because that's the whole point of the paper. So. And he has derived a very interesting, what he calls gravitational energy flux formula. The change in the area, which is to say the change in the entropy, if you put some shear on there, and this is a shear parameter, and this is a sort of rotation parameter. This is a bit involved, and I'm not going to go into it, A, because it's not my work, and B, because we're involved in work in progress on this. Basically, the form of this formula means you have to focus on Kerr. You have to have some rotation around. These two things sort of go hand in hand. And that makes sense, because if you know about, for example, when a black hole radiates gravitons, it spins down. And that's exactly what's happening. It radiates a graviton, loses a little shear, loses a little spin. Or conversely, you could spin it up. But anyway, this is how much the entropy, if you like, he's interpreting again as an energy flux. I'm interpreting now as an entropy flux in a certain way, changes. So you might say, well, okay, your work is done. And I would emphasize as well, by the way, this came out after our paper, so we didn't have access to this particular result. But you might just say, okay, that's it. You simply call this thing S dot K. We're home free. However, it's not that simple, because entropy, of course, can be created. It's not just that I can equate, it's not just that I can put S dot K in here and say, okay, S dot K is this. There was an entropy in the graviton before I threw it over the horizon. It went over the horizon increased, so there's an increase in the entropy, and therefore that exact same amount of entropy that was in the graviton before it went in is now reflected in this change, because entropy increases. So things are more subtle, and that is in fact the entire point of this discussion about whether or not the shear really is a good measure of the entropy. And I'll just mention an idea that we had, that one assumption that I mentioned, the covariant Bekenstein bound, as we called it, the assumption of theorem 2, is tantalizing, at least initially we thought it was, because, again, you have what looks like a purely quantum mechanical constraint on the matter, and you have what looks like, quote, a quantum gravity constraint on the shear part, the graviton part. But as you'll note, I've written in that we've concluded no. That's not the right way to think about this. If anything, this is a bound in some sense on linearized graviton information. Now, what I'm going to be doing today is I'm going to be just saturating the assumptions of the bound. In other words, I'm going to play around with the theorem. So, you know, I have some assumptions. As long as I don't violate those assumptions, I'm fine. I'm consistent with the entropy bound. So I'm going to see what happens when I saturate the bound in the gravitational sector, in the shear sector. But that raises the question, how do we saturate the bound? And so we included in the paper a little set of conditions on when you can saturate the bound. And in order to explain those, I'll just run through the Flanagan-Marof-Wald derivation briefly of the bound, and then we can see how these conditions arise. So what you do is you define this area functional, which you can think of as the ratio of the area, cross-sectional area at some given value of lambda. You flow along some distance lambda. It's the ratio of the area of this sphere to that sphere, if you like. And then you can define g to be the square root of that. Then the entropy through the light sheet takes that integral form, where again all of the curves in the congruence are running between 0 and 1 in terms of their affine parameter. I can do that. And the Boussinesq bound then becomes the statement. Then along each curve, I have an inequality of this form. I can then get rid of some of that stuff using the Ray-Chaudhuri equation. And you just go through some algebra, and you find that the covariant Bekenstein bound implies the Boussinesq bound if we assume null energy. I'm just flashing these slides because by looking at all these equations carefully, you can read off the conditions of saturation. Conditions of saturation are, one, that the final area is zero. So what this means is that we only terminate at caustics. We don't stop the light sheet sooner on some surface with finite area. Theta near lambda equals zero needs to be zero or near zero. So it's like you're near a horizon. So that's nice. Like I said, you want to saturate. Good bounds are those which saturate when you form black holes. That's consistent with that. And what's really interesting is that the source of the entropy should be near the points of vanishing expansion. And that's, of course, consistent with the membrane paradigm, the idea that you can think of degrees of freedom as living at the horizon. So those are just words. That's a very general theoretical derivation.
Hold on. Can you just
yeah.
This a little older?
Yeah. Yeah. So terminate at caustics, horizon, matter only near horizon, matter contributing to. For full
section. Also had this generalization where they didn't terminate at caustics.
Exactly. That would be the generalized. So that's what I mean by only the weak. Yeah. So these are just words. I'm going to go through an example which shows exactly how this works, basically, now.
Just to read
using matter.
Condition three is that it's either a case of zero expansion or at the end when everything.
Right. Right. Could there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So again, let me just go through an example, then it will become a little bit clearer. So what I'm going to do is the old shell of matter routine. We've all done this. make a black hole with a shell. Very straightforward. So I'm going to take a shell. And what the shell is it on the outside is Schwarzschild, and on the inside it's flat space, and I'm going to lower the shell in, and I'm going to make a black hole. Okay. So that means I use the Israel junction conditions. So the metric is the same, both inside and outside. It takes the standard spherically symmetric form. Outside it's Schwarzschild, inside it's Minkowski. I've rescaled this coordinate because the time-like coordinate on the shell has to match the time-like coordinate on each side. I have Killing vectors, in particular time-like Killing vectors, therefore I have energy, so I have energy. I have the condition that these rays are null, and so I have a relation for dr d lambda. I'm going to let my Busseau bound start just outside the shell. I'm going to shoot it in. It's going to be a spherical Busseau-like sheet. It's going to hit the shell at lambda naught, and I'm going to get a delta function contribution to the entropy at that point. So then all I have to do is work out the stress tensor. The stress tensor follows from the Israel junction conditions. In the usual way. Yeah. Sure. Shell, I'm lowering it down to lower and lower radius, and I'm crossing it with a light sheet. And so there's going to be a delta function contribution to the light sheet.
So is the light sheet hitting the shell before the shell has formed, has passed its one Schwarzschild?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to take a limit.
Will it be random point place, or are you going to take a limit, or it's going to...
Yeah, it's going to approach the right entropy in the limit, yeah.
In the limit the where the shell meets the...
Like, the Schwarzschild radius.
When it crosses
yeah.
The Schwarzschild radius.
Exactly, yeah.
This is a future direction.
Yeah. Okay. So I determine the stress tensor using the Israel conditions, and in the usual way, I get this familiar form for the energy density in the shell. And so I do the integral, and I get a delta function contribution. And again, the bound is that this is less than or equal to this. And so I'm seeing saturation at the very point that the shell is lowered to the Schwarzschild radius, because this term goes away and I just get a quarter. So I'm getting exactly A over 4G. Perhaps I should put up the previous equation because this...
Yeah. When you say you describe the geometrical calculation of certain geometry, you talk about the areas.
Yeah.
And now when you say that this is saturated, I mean, where is the entropy?
I simply took the stress energy tensor, right? The entropy flux vector is going to... I'm sorry, I missed the key point here. Yeah, I should have... This is actually the point that... Is that right? Yeah, I'm assuming saturation. I'm terribly sorry. Of the assumption of the theorem, which is that S dot K is less than or equal to KAB. KA, KB. I'm assuming this is saturated. So that's actually S dot K. Yes, sorry about that. So assuming saturation of covariant entropy bound, then I see saturation when I lower the shell down to its Schwarzschild radius in this very simple little cartoon calculation, yes. And I would mention that this is consistent with some interesting work of Pretorik, Volek, and Israel, which was much more involved, where they lower a shell with some equation of state in, and they hold it in thermodynamic equilibrium with its local Unruh temperature, and they also see saturation. This is a very much simpler calculation than what they did, but similar in spirit. I was inspired by them. Yes?
Just a simple question. When H bar isn't 1, there's an H bar in that equation.
Oh, yeah.
Where is that? Is that 1 over H bar on the right hand side?
I think H bar is on the left, yeah.
Okay.
So 1 over H bar on the right hand side. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So.
Yep. And here you're not worrying about the fact that the stresses in the shell must become enormous near the horizon when you lower it down. The static shell.
That's a good point. It's basically becoming infinite, the stresses will. The transverse stresses.
Singular limit.
Yeah, it's a singular limit. But that's a fair point. Those things are infinite. That's the problem with the gravistar model of Mottola and Mazur, right? Is the transverse pressure would have to be infinite to support that thing. Yeah. Okay. And similarly, we make some speculations about the Bekenstein bound, which I'm not going to go into here. There's a big puzzle, which was raised originally by Penrose, to my knowledge. What if there is no TAB, and indeed there is no TAB in the Schwarzschild solution, sort of in its pure mathematical form? It's just a vacuum solution. But we still might believe that it has some area. Yeah?
The moral we were supposed to take away from this lowering of the shell.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. What? We saw all the degrees of freedom living right at the horizon when saturation occurred. We saw all three of those things come true. We saw that the light sheet was right near the horizon. We saw that the degrees of freedom, which were being counted, were right near the horizon. It was consistent with the membrane paradigm, basically. That's the moral that I take away from it. And we're going to see a similar thing with the gravitational degrees of freedom, that the ones I count, at least, sit down near the horizon. So the degrees of freedom are sitting near the horizon.
Is the light sheet supposed to start sort of infinitesimally outside the shell and then get completely as it goes through? There seems to be some randomness in the way you start the light sheet.
Right, you're saying, can I start it arbitrarily? It's the way we did it. It was just outside the shell, and we went through the shell. But the moral is that the saturation was occurring when the degrees of freedom in question were right near the point at which the horizon forms, consistent with the membrane paradigm. In a similar way to in Horowitz-Polchinski in this correspondence point, the string, it's right when the string is at the rate.
So the situation of what is occurring. So,
saturation.
That's the picture, right? It seems to me that you can make it not saturated by just starting the light sheet further out. If it was saturated for some light sheet and you just started out with a bigger area, it wasn't. So there seems to be some rule about where you started out.
Right. The way we did the calculation, it was just outside the shell. So
within sort of an infinitely thin shell, they focus from... It's a spherically symmetric problem, so I don't understand how, as the light rays pass through the shell, they can lose all of their cross-sectional area. You said that...
Lose all of their cross-sectional area. Because...
Are they supposed to go all the way towards the center?
Right, the middle is a flat space, yeah.
So then they would violate the generalized version of the if you just stopped the light sheet earlier.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. I'm sorry, yeah. Inside is flat space. It's a little TP. So, yeah. Okay.
If you had a non-sheet, then it would say.
Sure. As I'll mention in a minute, when you take non-spherical light sheets in Schwarzschild, you get pure. Yeah, that's right.
So, a different way of saying what you're saying would be just that in the limit where you, with this saturation assumption, in the limit where you make the shell as large as its own Schwarzschild radius, it will have the same entropy as the black hole it is forming.
Right.
Actually, can we go back to Sundin for a minute? I mean, what you wrote on the board is not exactly one of the two assumptions. There was one.
Yeah.
That has a gradient in it. There's one that has the left side squared.
Yeah.
And are you using both of them saturated or just one?
I'm sorry. Yeah, squared. Yeah.
In that case, the answer to Steve's question is, not, is there an H bar in there, but then a G in this equation as well? Right?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I'm just suppressing all of them, unless everyone wants me to put them back in. So, okay. All right. So. So, based on this little puzzle, it's not a puzzle really, I mean, because no one thinks like this anymore, but it was a puzzle at that time, Penrose suggested, could we think of this entropy as being purely gravitational? And so, I actually thought about this, but what struck me about these bounds is that this opens up a window through which you could perhaps approach this problem and see the extent to which that sort of intuition could have been right. However, there's another puzzle, and that is that any spherically symmetric light sheet has vanishing shear in Schwarzschild. It has no shear, so evidently it's not seeing any gravitational degrees of freedom. However, Josh and I had nothing much to do, so we started playing around. And so the first thing we played around with was, let's break the symmetry of the light sheet. And so, for example, if you put in an elliptical light sheet, like Harvey was saying, with minor axis B, major axis A, then you start to see some shear going through the light sheet. So for some reason, those light sheets that don't see the symmetry of the space that they're living in start to see shear entropy. So this raises the question, is it the case that in this context smaller is better?
But there's no entropy there. You just change the shape of the initial area. I mean, I can always use shapes that give you, you know, bounds, they give you bounds that are further from saturation by just choosing, you know, but by not judiciously choosing my initial surface area.
You can do it in flat space, you say.
Yeah, I mean, I can just here in flat space, it'll have no, you know, entropy at all, and it'll still. You know, so then I can make it a larger sphere or something that's shaped like a flower or something, and it'll still be true that zero is less than that area, but it doesn't mean I can conclude from the fact that I just choose a different area that there's more entropy.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. The key thing is, the key question I'm trying to get at, there's A, if we're in flat space, here's a thought experiment. I have a plane wave, gravitational wave. If I choose the light sheet to have the same plane or symmetry, it won't see any shear. If I choose the light sheet to have spherical symmetry, it will see the shear. You can shear it with the plane wave. So if I want to talk about that wave carrying information and how much information is it carrying, I might be tempted to say that the spherical light sheet is better for detecting the gravitational degrees of freedom associated with that wave than the plane-fronted light sheet. I'm suggesting, actually, that maybe there is some kind of shape dependence when
you're putting something in, which is this, which is the gravitational wave,
which is a real wave. And in the black hole case, there's a real thing there. There's a black hole. So one thing you start to notice is that small enough light sheets always break the symmetry of your ambient space. And so this led us to the crazy idea of what happens if we try and build a light sheet by summing over a whole bunch of small little light sheets. So that's what we did. And this is all order of magnitude from here on out. So what I did first, what we did, was we took a constant time slice in static exterior patch coordinates in Schwarzschild. We computed the shear tensor, which has some leading order behavior. We calculated the entropy in a shell of small balls sitting at some given radius. So we calculate the entropy through a given small light sheet. And then we do it in a shell, and then we integrate out over all the shells the total shear entropy in all of those light sheets. And what you find, well, there's a problem. There's two regulators. The first regulator is the size of the little shells, the little balls from which the light sheets emanate. And the other is the distance from the horizon down to which you want to integrate, because it's going to get infinite if you go all the way down to the horizon. So we just set both of these regulators to be equal to the Planck length. It doesn't really matter what we set them equal to. They're the same. And we found that the entropy scales, at least, like the area. So this was one way in which Penrose might have been right. And so you could ask the question, was he right all along? Is the origin of black hole entropy in the shear? Is it actually the gravitational degrees of freedom sitting in the space-time? And the answer is no. Go ahead. Yeah, sorry. The answer is.
So now you're drawing all the little spheres.
Yeah.
And you said you calculated the shear entropy. Do you mean by that? So the light sheets from these little spheres would contract, of course, to a point no matter what.
Uh-huh. We didn't even worry about
isolating the part in the Ray Chowdhury equation. Are you isolating the shear part and sort of integrating that up and calling that the shear entropy?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It was a very order of magnitude thing. For each one of the little light sheets, we had an estimate on sort of how large the shear was. We had a size, you know, sort of a length of the affine parameter. It was all order of magnitude. It was very simple. No,
you're not calling the shear entropy the initial area of this thing. You're calling it only the part of the area loss that came from the shear.
Exactly. Well, again, I'm saturating the bound, this bound, with shear. I'm setting s dot k equal to shear squared, and then I'm integrating s dot k, i.e. shear squared, along each of the little light sheets. And that's giving me some crude estimate of how much shear was living on each of those little light sheets. And I'm summing all of the overall of the little light sheets. It's a very crinkly light sheet. It's a crazy array of little teepees or something.
Why is there a divergence if you take these things all the way down to the horizon?
there just isn't. And why? I mean,
space that arises nice and flat, scale r squared. Why shouldn't I just have a finite number of these things?
Well, this is probably an example of coordinate dependence. I've chosen, again, static exterior coordinates, right? And generically, it's the same reason why if you try to hold a particle with a, you're sort of seeing the infinite tidal force, I think, by using this coordinate. You're absolutely right. By using other coordinates, you could have another slicing, which went right through and was fine and was happy, and light sheets were happy and getting sheared inside and outside. We didn't do that calculation. It would be interesting to see what that calculation gives.
Does it depend on how large you choose the light, the initial areas, these little
cuts? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we took that. There were two cutoffs, again, two regulators, the size and how far you went down to the horizon. We took both of those to be the Planck length.
Is there also
the philosophy being there might be a stretched horizon which cuts it off and you can never get there.
Is there also a cutoff on how far away you go from the black hole?
I mean, no, because those die off. The balls at infinity aren't getting sheared. You got to be near the... And the reason, okay, so you can ask the question, is this the origin of black hole entropy? And the answer is a resounding no, because we know that a shell, I already told you that a shell of matter gives the right answer, so I could have the shell lower it down and then have all these little light sheets outside, so I could, you know, I would double count if this was the right answer. So I don't think this is the right way to think about it. What I think is that whatever this stuff is, and you might say that it's not entropy, you might say that I'm counting nothing, but if I am counting something that is a degree of freedom and you want to include it, it's some extra stuff. And so if you ever do decide that you believe in sheer entropy, I would say that you should add in an extra gravitational piece to your matter piece and your black hole piece, and then I would have a generalized second law, which tells you that that never decreases. So this is a tighter second law, because there's more stuff.
There must have been some sense of gravity. I don't just not following the details of which gravity must have always been included. If you had guessed a graviton, you would have counted that.
I'm coming to, yeah. Okay. That's exactly the suggestion that Gibbons made when I gave this talk. That point can be debated, but if I'm right, I have to answer the question, what microscopic degrees of freedom are actually being counted allegedly in this construction. And so, turns out, actually, Gary had thought about this a long time ago, and his point is that they count gravitons. He produced this ancient paper by Zeldovich, in which he did a computation that, given an electromagnetic field, if you expand the field into sort of an assembly of waves, assume UV, i.e. a Planck scale in this context, and an IR, i.e. the size of the light sheet in this context, cut off, then there's a natural notion of invariant, which is a photon number, basically, operator, associated with these fields. And so you could think, let's do the same computation for linearized gravitons. I've got a small region just outside the black hole. Let's do the calculation. Well, it turns out that Gary actually knew more. In a footnote, Ashtikar mentions doing this calculation, but he lost the note. So that was easy. So we thought we were nearly there. So no, so far the calculation has not been done. But Gary, back of the envelope, is getting integral C squared. Okay, so that's one proposal that would answer your question. Anyway, since I usually like to end a little early, I'll just end with saying that the sheer madness of gravitational entropy is still a work in progress, but I think the evidence is intriguing, and I hope this motivates other people to think about it. Thanks. Yes?
Don't the string theory black hole calculations show that if you were generalized, they could not be right?
Why?
Because they don't have an extra term on the right hand side.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so now all of those calculations are for extreme black. You have other fields turned on. You have matter. You have stress energy. Yeah.
But even for an extreme black hole, presumably you still get some non-zero answer if you did your small hole calculation.
Well, that's unclear. I mean, we had this conversation before, because down the throat, it's generically ADS cross S. It's Weyl flat down the throat. It's Bertardi-Robinson down the throat, generically, right? For the extreme case.
But there's a transition region between the throat and the asymptotic.
Where you would see shear. Yeah.
So you see some.
Yeah. That's fair enough. Yeah.
So what was your proposal? There should be this extra term which is given by the procedure with all these little balls around the algae?
Well, that would be one way of calculating it, yeah. I'm saying, you know, you might, somewhere far away from the black hole, there might just be a graviton cruising along, and you might want to.
So as Joe said, I think everyone would agree that gas of gravitons contributes entropy, but you're using a specific way to calculate that entropy?
Well, no, that calculation's in process, in progress. Yeah. That's not been done yet. But there is a proposal that Gibbons had. He'd actually thought of it way back in the 70s to do that calculation, yes. You do this Zeldovich calculation. You calculate some graviton number near the horizon, basically. Maybe that's been done. I don't know. Yes?
I mean, intuitively, it seems to me there's two different types of Weyl curvature. I mean, there's the Weyl curvature that you've been talking about here, which is sort of like a Coulomb field, the gravitational field. You
have the black hole, yeah.
Produces this Coulomb field. And I don't think that that should have much entropy. I mean, there's no degrees of freedom in that. Somehow it responds to whatever the source is doing. It's just sort of like a charge.
Yeah, you're saying I don't have to go all through space and measure the fact that there's some tidal force here, which is really what the Weyl curvature is telling you. And there's some.
Same thing to the right.
I mean, you don't consider that a piece of information, in other words.
No, you know, on the other hand, you have all of the gravitational radiation.
Yeah.
Where, you know, that's also Weyl curvature, but it's of a more dynamical sort. And that naturally might have some entropy.
But then again, if in the source of a Coulomb field, you get some graviton number, then you're willing to accept that that might be what we're counting, or?
I don't think you can't do that without having horizons. That's the whole point, right? A Coulomb field, right, there are no static, spherically symmetric, there are no static solutions, period, without horizons, right?
Sure.
So,
without the Earth?
He's talking about vacuum solutions.
Right. Entropy associated with the Earth. The gravitational field is not doing anything other than responding to what it has to do.
So you're saying we have to be very selective about what gravitational degrees of freedom we count. Is that what you're saying? Is this some selection rule?
But it's hard. I think that's one of the problems.
Formulating that, making that precise. Yeah.
Penrose's idea precisely, because I don't know a clear decomposition of the Weyl sort of radiation particle.
The same interaction with Fermi, don't come in. I mean, when I say energy on the electron, don't come in. You can think about the electron, and you can come in and an electric field is this way, or two, and then, but then when you have an electron, you don't think about the electric field is directly convenient.
Even if you have a guess of gravitons around, you separate that out, and I mean you still have some classical geometry that you refer to when you talk about area.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. You don't count the clock. Isn't there this? It's kind of separate. I mean, all these bounds refer to classical area. Not really an area that's fluctuating quantum mechanics.
Right,
it's classical. You always separate the two pieces, and it's not clear which piece your shear is in.
Right.
The classical piece or the fluctuation.
Right.
So the old way of doing it, the graviton, gas of graviton entropy would have included the matter entropy in generalized second Boltzmann?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure there was an old way of including the graviton, gas of graviton.
So there's always a bit of an ambiguity in how you define the gravitons, because you have to subtract the background to say that you have a graviton there, and there's no part of that story.
But I guess what it meant was that Don is kind of proof theorem, and the conditions in which that theorem would have been true, we would have had to include any entropy in the gas of gravitons in the matter.
No, you didn't.
Again, it's an inequality.
The assumptions were such that you could have ascribed entropy to gravitons and still satisfied the assumptions, as long as you didn't ascribe more than whatever sigma squared over something.
Yeah, exactly. The key thing is that this is an inequality, okay? The fact that you have this doesn't necessarily mean you have to have this, right? And in fact, what's interesting about that Ashtekar paper is that if you do just do the simple matching, what you actually find is that it's something like s dot k squared, so this is an eighth, is equal to sigma squared over 32 or something like that. There's a mysterious factor of 4. So you're not even saturating in that case, even if you wanted to play the game that the graviton entropy really is what's causing the increase in the black hole entropy, and there's no entropy being created. you get this mysterious factor of a fourth. But that's absolutely the whole point. That is the point of the debate is, according to the theorem, you don't have to have this if you have this. It's the other way around. It's if you have that, then you have to have that. So
if you model the background as a coherent state of gravitons, to what extent can you use uniform language to talk about the entropy and the gravitational field?
A uniform language,
I mean,
yeah.
If something is classical, we want to use geometry. If
yeah.
Talking about gravitational radiation, think about it as a gas of gravitons populated as if you just have a bath of massless particles.
I think those are different regimes, yeah, totally different, yeah.
Right, but I'm saying if you model the background as if it's just some coherent state of gravitons.
You mean a black hole as a coherent state of gravitons?
So you look at the coherent state.
I mean, you have zero.
Exactly.
Right.
Do these entropy bounds only hold some formal limit where the size of the system is larger than the Planck scale, or do they really make sense for a system which is 10 Planck units in size? No, they don't.
I think it's these are semi-classical statements.
Well, not in my head first.
Oh.
These are semi-classical statements. You're larger than the Planck scale. Yeah, so.
The formulation statements really make sense of the Planck scale.
Yeah.
There may
be some formal limit if you define them precisely.
There may be a quantum gravity entropy bound, though. There may be some notion.
Before you talk about area, when you talk about constructing light sheets, and so you have to be able to do that in a controlled way.
Thanks.